morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, June 6th, is known historically as D-Day, the date in 1944 when the World War II allies of France, Britain, and the USA struck back at Adolf Hitler's Festung Europa, his Fortress Europe, finally ending the Nazi regime that intended to conquer and rule the world in perpetuity. The two world wars against Germany in the first half of the 20th century left much of the world in ruins, great cities bombed to rubble. World War I bombers were crude and clumsy, unable to haul big enough bomb loads for real damage. Yet they killed and maimed thousands of soldiers and civilians, and more significant to the human psyche, made the very sky that envelops the earth the most dangerous threat to human existence. Of the 60 million or more human beings who died in the Second World War, a considerable majority died in bombing attacks, which included the first two nuclear bombs. Only the Nazi death camps exceeded the horror of living underneath aerial warfare. My own entrance to war was also a beach landing, but it was not contested. Just another shipload of U.S. Marines coming ashore to fight the Vietnam War in 1966. We floated up a river and landed on the beach at Chu Lai, I Corps, South Vietnam, in March that year, and spent the next few days AWOL from ship unloading and eventually moved up a hill above the South China Sea. A couple of days later, my shipboard mates and I entered the war. Some of them died in the war itself, and others of us are dying now, many, many years afterward. The latest was John Michael Sweeney from Minneapolis, Minnesota, one of my very closest friends in Vietnam. He just died a couple of days ago, although he's been sick for a very, very long time, probably from something he picked up while in Vietnam. I start today's program with something I wrote, War in Our Time, and with a quote by Pablo Picasso, "And with all power, the pigeon flocks dash into the rifle bullets, and in all bombed houses, the keys turn twice around in the locks." And that was from Desire Caught by the Tail, which he wrote in 1941, the year the United States entered World War II, and I was born that year. I'm a war baby, without ever having a shot fired at me in my youth anyway. My early youth. Late spring or early summer, when the ground is dry and hard, is traditionally the season when winter restless armies clash. It is almost a contradiction. When life is renewed, armies sharpen their spears, load their cannon. But perhaps men make war because they are unable to give birth the continuing winter of their discontent. Winter's soldiers. "There is no good war and no bad peace," Benjamin Franklin said. But peace is also defined as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce more and newer weapons, sow newer crops of human fodder to continue the genocides of their fathers. As with most other effects of insatiable technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure nation, are able to make war anytime, any place. State-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, credit, or good prospects. Even drug gangs in American ghettos are armed with high-status automatic weapons, as are sociopaths and vengeful boys who spray school playgrounds with bullets. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotic weapons and high-tech weapon systems, vicariously enraptured by the increased carnage rockets and jet fighter bombers make of tribal-level squabbles. Perhaps abstract engagement in wars made possible by outlandish weapons designed in the manner of video games and ardently viewed on TV screens is verification of the popularity of reality through image without participation. This de facto decadence might be related to the hallucinatory dread of nuclear obliteration, which has been almost too large a horror to bear for more than half a century. It seems inconceivable that humanity has made itself capable of its own extinction, and that by our own will we can disappear from history as absolutely as dinosaurs and dodo birds. Most folks refuse to think we could be so foolish, yet they suspect our leaders have few qualms or sufficient fears, urged instead to the possibility of the unthinkable by the prospects of opportunity. In such a world, reality hurts. We turn away as we would from a glare of sunlight. We submerge into banality to moot our angst. Genesis might be a warning. Instead of a myth of instant birth, it is a prophecy of mega death. Perhaps we are still in the Garden of Eden, which is a metaphor for life. Evil might not be sex after all, or knowledge, but humanity's careless brutality that leads irresistibly toward plucking the ripe fruit of specicide. War has advanced civilization as brutally as it has destroyed civilizations. Humanity is as accustomed to warfare as breathing and copulating. The rewards are grossly unequal. Those who suffer most from war rarely win, no matter which opponents are victorious. War is blood, carnage, and death, which is so obvious a fact, we often ignore it in our preoccupation with the rationales, strategies, and technologies of war. War has affected civilization tremendously, but its effect upon those who suffer firsthand is given little consideration. Wars determine the reaction and consequent effect upon a society, and recovery is often a long, slow process. Those with personal involvement in a war are not accorded the same respect for their own process of recovery. Their private horrors and nightmares of war are dealt with impatiently and with scorn at possible psychological or physical disabilities, though collectively these sorts of disruptions and discontinuities are accepted as part of the historical process. The ambiguity of history might be encompassed in a phrase used often by Oliver Cromwell and others: pray for peace, prepare for war. Earth bristles with preparation. Yet a grim irony of this era is that we have reduced human participation in warfare, with the exception of possibly dying, in unheard of numbers. The invention of the harpoon gun and the exploding harpoon decimated the whale. The chainsaw has cut down the world's forests. By also inventing such weapons as the machine gun and hydrogen bomb, we almost match our reckless destruction of the home planet by abetting our own extinction. We have perfected war, refined it to an instrument of digital logic that no longer depends upon human rationale or justification, no philosophy or psychology, only strategy and provocation. Although armies are unnecessary now, they are kept around to engage in traditional fratricide without provoking megadeath. Dead soldiers are like the Christ in a sense. They die as surrogates for the rest of us. Unrestricted warfare of the 20th century also enlarged the soldiers, always shadowy and disavowed parallel role as surrogate executioners. Of course, everyone professes hatred for warfare, but truth is, we are a savagely warlike species whose penchant for clever, organized violence has made us supreme on Earth. We have throughout history honored the killers among us, and as we became more settled and civilized, the laurels inevitably transferred from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of human beings. All of our great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest and often decimation of tribes, cities, or nations unlucky to be along the march of more ambitiously militant societies. Although Americans like to think of themselves as a peaceable society, we are among history's most successfully warlike. Our nation was created by war, maintained its union by war, became a continental power by invading our southern neighbor and stripping it of its northern half, and became a world power by terminating the decrepit colonial empire of another. The two world wars made the USA a superpower, during which we built a war machine unsurpassed in history, while demonstrating a productive capacity that overwhelmed allies and enemies alike. This nation now dominates global politics with its immense and highly sophisticated potential for total war as the only reigning superpower after emerging successfully from a half-century Cold War against Soviet Russia, which was characterized by inconclusive brushfire wars and a horrendous nuclear arms race that economically and politically broke our competitor but seriously injured our own economies and ideologies, and, quite possibly, unhinged our sanities. In all, the USA has fought in 11 major wars, but one must also not forget the incessant three-century war against Native Americans, which is comparably among the most savage and genocidal ever fought. Our expansion across the continent, our manifest destiny, necessitated in the minds of the expansionists the continued extermination of the primeval tribes whose brave but pitiful resistance against extinction was no match for our weapons and determination to possess their homelands. To this purpose, in addition to obliteration of any tribe within reach, was the use of disease, the deliberate spread of smallpox among tribes who might more adequately defend their territory than others. Perhaps the past can be dismissed as irrelevant, but we are incapable of living outside history. We are what we are as a result of history. We are a proud and warlike nation, and we believe our way of life is on the march, that our ideological genes will be grafted onto the global DNA and transform the world into our cultural replica. With virtual dissolution of our Cold War nemesis, we surge forth as missionary warriors. Simply settling into peaceful coexistence is not enough and has never been. This is the new world order, the military dominance of world affairs by the United States of America. As we parade into this new millennium world order, we should think about dangerous erosions to our principles of liberty and self-determination by embracing global military supremacy, not wholly unlike Rome's exchange of a republic for the rule of Caesars soon after it became the world's first superpower. With more influence than property, the USA acts as industrial civilization's police force, which presumes the real job of a cop is to not only protect the status quo, but enforce it. To hope that democracy might successfully coexist with military rule is to have missed the point that the United States has functioned as a war technology and national security state since at least World War II and earlier, the Alien and Sedition Acts, for example. Looking at history through only the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet wars shape nations and individuals. Much of what each claims as heritage and honor is bequeathed by war. Waging war is a nation's most serious business. Robert E. Lee said it was probably fortunate war is so terrible, otherwise we might grow to love it. He had not foreseen its possibilities as video entertainment, such as the Persian Gulf War and the air war over Serbia, provided with smart missiles and bombs, breaking down doors or falling through factory chimneys. A few cynics predict that future wars will be instigated against poor Southern Hemisphere countries to keep the audience ratings high, not the unfortunate spectacle of dead Americans dragged through streets as happened in Somalia, but high-tech air war stuff in which the warriors anonymously and indiscriminately, always hotly denied, murder strangers from the stratosphere. Most significant to the human psyche is that 20th century air war made the very sky that envelops the earth the most dangerous threat to existence. A people will generally support a war once it is initiated, if for no other reason than they feel that there is not much else they can do. That support is considered essential for conducting a war to its end in victory or defeat. In this era of the supposed common person, the focus of support is upon the average soldier, sailor, and airman or woman, who are not responsible for the wars they fight in, but make possible. Bellicose war fever is whipped up to discourage questions of a war's purpose or cost, and to disguise the contradiction that supporting a soldier's warlike duty is a sure way of killing or injuring him or her. The enthusiastic outpouring of love and support for the American GI might act instead as a relentless advancing wall that pushes troops into irreversible horror. At the same time, it crushes underneath its cheering war cries any who would conscientiously object. The soldiers feel compelled to carry out what they see as public mandate, and in the belief that any doubts of their own would be met with disapproval, they would do their duty at whatever cost. Instead of the usual honors as heroes, we should pity the hallowed war dead as fools, or curse them for being soldiers. It is almost too simple, but without soldiers, there would be no wars. Without soldiers, Caesar would be a scheming minor politician, Napoleon, frustratingly Napoleonic, Hitler, an inferior decorator. Soldiers kill, rape, pillage, burn, and if they are unlucky, stupid, or badly led, they die. If masses of men would not immerse themselves into armies and navies, warfare would diminish as a human affliction. All the old deceits and antipathies would continue to burn in our flailing breasts, but the scale of havoc would be greatly reduced. Oregon's own John Reed saw the sinister side of soldiers and anticipated the civic consequence of military rule. "I hate soldiers," he wrote. "I hate to see a man with a bayonet on his rifle who can order me off the street. I hate to belong to an organization that is proud of being a caste of superior beings, that is proud of killing free ideas so that it may more effectively kill human beings." This is not the currently popular attitude toward members of the armed forces. It is, however, a historically accurate one. The very troops we are exhorted to love and cherish can be turned against us, ordered to suppress dissent and round up political activists. The chilling thought is that in times like these, such repressive acts could have popular support, at least initially, as happened during the Vietnam War. With the use of police and national guards, national security is boilerplated over the Constitution. Vietnam taught us that perpetual war is probably impossible without perpetual public support. That can be a provocation for rallying around the flag and tying it with a yellow ribbon. It is a better argument for refusing to endorse a war so that it might quickly end or perhaps never begin. The war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent against their wars as sedition and disloyalty. But dissent is necessary. It is the true act of patriotism, and it is a more reasonable way to support the troops than sending them against other armies. History's dark glare shines on an earth too fragile for the titanic clashes of its past. Humanity, however, responds quicker to hatred and opportunity than to peace for its own sake, and never are these traits more well represented than through a war's victors arguing over the spoils of a defeated nation. Civilizations have profited immensely from wars, and warfare has progressed civilizations' expanse and technologies. Yet war has also turned out the lights of civilization. Humanity has been set back centuries by its predilection for war, long periods of decline and retrogression, generations denied opportunities of learning and rebuilding, interminable cycles of darkness. Human antipathy does not go away easily or for very long. Old hatreds scab over only briefly and soon re-erupt. Someone, somewhere, covets something possessed by a neighbor, land, wealth, power. An insurgency plans an assault or ambush. A newly established nuclear power readies to flex it on an old enemy. Big war stuff trickles down from defunct Cold War arsenals into the grubby little hands of school children who arm themselves like gunfighters or gangsters. Peace-loving peoples commit genocide upon neighbors. Large parts of the world act as laundries for ethnic cleansing. Countries or persons publicly declare themselves as peace-loving, yet act as vicious attack dogs. Peace is not on the earth, but a few feet under it for millions who are slaughtered by fellow humans for reasons peripheral and perishable. "With them in hell," wrote Wilfred Owen, regarded as the best poet of World War I and perhaps the best war poet ever, killed a week before armistice. "The sorrowful dark of hell, whose world is but the trembling of a flare, and heaven but as the highway for a shell." This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. John Michael Sweeney, former U.S. Marine combat correspondent and one of my closest war buddies in Vietnam, has recently, after years of severe illness, most likely contracted in Vietnam, died. He is not the first of my war pals to die since coming home. Andrew Murray Williams likely suicided. He seemed related to several big-shot government officials. Frank Hosso, a Pima Indian, drank himself to death, like the famous Ira Hayes, also an American Indian, who helped raise the U.S. flag on Iwo Jima. Clifford McKenzie died while playing basketball with local immigrants in New York. Only a few of us who are the closest are still alive now, all these years later. Vietnam veterans seem to be the oldest American war veterans still alive.
You've been listening to A Story Told on KMUN, featuring Michael McCusker, journalist, activist, former firefighter, and Vietnam veteran. Michael has been sharing essays and poetry on A Story Told since 1987. For 30 years, he published the North Coast Times-Eagle newspaper out of his home in Astoria, Oregon. Michael currently shares his work and the works of other authors from his home on the Central Oregon coast. Join us here next week for A Story Told.